This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On DAB Plus and on the Talk Radio app.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We are, of course, with the Veterans Railcard. Just a single day service in the armed forces qualifies you for the Veterans Railcard. Visit railcard.co.uk to apply. We'll take some of your calls very shortly, but first up, we're going to talk now to Tony Smith, former head of the UK Border Force, because it turns out, right, that yet again, there has been another record broken yesterday. And don't forget, we are now in the midst of November. It's the 11th of November yesterday. Basically, more people than ever came across the channel, landed on our shores, over 1,000, right, making the so-called perilous trip to the UK. It's supposed to have all died down because we're supposed to be going into the winter months, but the weather's been quite calm. The sea was obviously quite calm yesterday. What is going on and when the hell is it going to stop? Tony, very good morning to you.
Morning, Mike.
I mean, it beggars belief, this, doesn't it? I mean, this has been the single biggest number of people that have come over in any given year. I think we're now looking at somewhere approaching 30,000. Possibly it'll be 40,000 by the time we get to the end of the year. I mean, it's unbelievable. Why can we not do something about it?
Well, I think it started with a finger in the dike, Mike, a couple of years ago. And I'm afraid that, you know, the barriers are breaking now. People are realising that this route is viable. I understand that things are really not that smooth out on the channel. Right. People are still coming across, though. They're putting lives at risk. The border force is struggling to pick up these numbers.
Yeah.
People are being sick on board. They're arriving in very poor conditions, Mike. There's nowhere to put them. Tuckhaven is only a temporary facility. Yeah. It's a pretty awful scenario. And it reminds me, Mike, of my time, you know, 20 years ago when we had a similar influx across the channel coming on ferries. In those days, they were literally camping on the streets of Dover. And we found ourselves with a problem that's still, you know, taken a great many years to fix with infrastructure capability to manage. It's horrendous.
Well, it really is. I mean, my understanding of the child services in Dover and in that part of southeast Kent, they're just literally overwhelmed. They're overrun. They have been for a long time. And we don't even really know, Tony, do we, where a lot of these people are ending up? You know, I know from personal experience of people that talk to me who live down there, that there's an awful lot of people arriving that we don't even count because they're literally getting off a boat, walking into the town under their own steam. No border force in tow, no RNLI, nothing. They're just landing in places like Dungeness, landing in places like Bexhill, landing in other parts of the southeast coast, which are not patrolled particularly.
Well, that's right. I mean, and we, you know, when we do pick them up, if we do pick them up, Mike, the infrastructure isn't there, I'm afraid, to be able to accommodate them and to feed them through into what is a system that the government has already recognised to be broken. And so there are vast numbers of people coming into this country. We haven't had a proper opportunity to screen them all. And to be frank, I'm not sure we know where they all are or where they're all going. So it is really a mess. And we really must try to stop the boats, as we've said before, Mike, but it takes two to tango. And I'm afraid the French are not coming to the dance floor at the moment with us, as I understand it. They're refusing to discuss a safe third country agreement, which is perfectly achievable in international law. It's something I've been advocating for 2 years now. And my understanding, though, is that the French simply won't discuss that. They're happy to work on the beaches, to do what they can on land, but they will not engage in returns. And that is the crux of the matter.
Yes, and it looks as though Whitehall is starting to leak to that effect, saying that the French are basically not doing their part. They're ceding sovereign territory to people smugglers. They're allowing these operations to go ahead. I mean, it was pointed out to me last week when they sort of impounded that British trawler that, you know, the French seem capable of stopping a fishing boat if they want to, but they can't seem to stop any of the dinghies leaving their shores.
Yeah, well, so we're conflating international law with political issues here, Mike, but there is no question. I've been in this business for a great many years, far more years than I care to remember. There is no reason at all in international law why we cannot come to a bilateral agreement with France on joint patrols and returns. That's permissible under the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea. People do not fear persecution in France. Mike, it is a safe country. They have their own asylum system, but the EU has its own migratory problems, and they are being conflated into all kinds of things, as you say, like fishing, Brexit, Northern Ireland, to a political level where the government cannot return people simply because there's an intransigence on behalf of the other party to take them back.
Yeah.
That's a political issue that could be fixed with political agreement. And I think it's the political leaders that are the ones that should be challenged on this. Not just our own, because I think our own are trying, Mike. I really do. But I think the French need to be held to account on what is their position on this and what are they going to do to help us save lives.
Right. But all you've got to do as well is cast your eyes slightly further east to the Belarus-Poland border, Tony, where you can see hordes and hordes of people trying to get into Poland because they know once they're in the EU, they can basically travel freely across it, get themselves to France and inevitably get themselves to Dover.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. It's hypocritical, isn't it, of the EU? Because, you know, we are seeing troops amassed along the Polish border police, stopping people getting into the EU through that route. We've got a Greece agreement with Turkey that people coming across the Mediterranean are being stopped from getting in that way. And we've got the same thing at the other side of the EU, which is completely in reverse, and they're refusing to take people back when that's precisely what they're doing on their Eastern Front. Mm. So it is hypocritical of the EU. But we need to let's get back to humanity, Mike. This is organised international crime. Lots of criminals, they care nothing for human life. They're making millions and they will make millions more, and they are laughing at the establishment at the moment because we're just simply fueling the supply chains and creating misery. And Mike, sadly, more people are going to die. People are going to drown. And we have a duty, I think, between two civilised countries, the UK and France, founder members of the 51 Convention on Refugees, to sit down and work this out.
Yeah, absolutely right. Tony, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Former head of UK Border Force, Tony Smith there.
This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online, on DAB+, and on the Talk Radio app.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We are, of course, the home of common sense. And if you've been paying attention, you might know that we haven't exactly been entirely supportive of COP26 as it's been going on up in Glasgow for the best part of the last 2 weeks. I don't know what they've been talking about, what they've been doing. But in order to find out, we've got Harry Wilkinson here with us, head of policy at Net Zero Watch, who was there because you didn't have to go. So, Harry, welcome back to civilization.
Good morning.
The climate's not looking very good. They haven't fixed that yet, have they? It's still raining.
No, well, it's been a eye-opening experience going to COP26.
Yeah.
What I think we've seen is a sort of collection of the world's elites gathering together to basically tell the rest of the world how to live their lives.
Yeah, but also not to even agree on how that should be.
That's right. And we've seen significant tensions opening up, essentially between developing countries and developed countries.
Yes.
Like the UK and the US and European Union countries,
right,
who basically want to bribe the developing countries to accept all these restrictions,
yeah,
on fossil fuel development.
Right.
And of course, these politicians from around the world, they don't necessarily represent their population's best interests.
No.
Economic growth is the best possible thing,
mm, well, of course,
that they could deliver.
And also, it's rather condescending, isn't it, for people from, say, I don't know, London, to tell people from Papua New Guinea, absolutely no more foreign holidays for you, chummy, you know, because they can't afford to go on foreign holidays. They don't fly anywhere because they've got any money.
That's right. And I think I was able to fly here, and it was a great to Glasgow and back again.
And amazingly, and the airport wasn't closed off to you because of all the private jets that were landing there and reparking themselves at Prestwick, 30 miles down the road.
I felt, seeing everyone else flying in, that I couldn't miss out on flying the only sort of acceptable way to COP.
I mean, I personally have not been on a plane since 2019, right, when I last went to Portugal at the end of August. That's my sacrifice, right? Not because of climate change, but because of the bleeding lockdown.
That's right. And although it's been hard denying ourselves these things, when you get to experience them again, it helps you realise just what an extraordinary and fortunate society,
yeah,
that we're lucky to be a part of. And we want those privileges for the whole world.
Yes.
And what we're seeing at COP is essentially a conspiracy by world leaders to actually deny these benefits to the whole world.
Yes.
And that's really sad.
It really is. And it's very hypocritical. And it seems to me that what we've been looking at over the best part of the last sort of week and a half is total and utter nonsense, really. Because you've got Leonardo DiCaprio flying in 8,000 miles in a private jet with his latest girlfriend to pick up an award for being green. And you go, am I the only person that sees this as a little bit of a nonsense? I mean, did they take themselves terribly seriously in your experience? Or were you greeted like the sort of devil incarnate whenever you turned up anywhere?
Well, the hypocrisy is breathtaking. You see people with their coteries of various bag carriers and these huge delegations. And whether they all need to be there is highly questionable.
Well, of course they don't. I mean, first of all, they could have done the meeting on Zoom, right? Second of all, just by turning up and bringing sort of 50 or 100 people with them, Joe Biden, I think, probably wins the prize for that, bringing 85 different cars in his presidential motorcade. I mean, it just beggars belief, doesn't it?
Yes, we were told that this event was so important that they just had to meet in person,
uh-huh,
and yet they've taken all these excess delegates, and they've also claiming that it's 1 minute to midnight and the world will end if we emit too much carbon. If it really was that important, and if they really believed these exaggerated claims, which don't ally with the science on climate change, the science is showing that actually fewer people are dying of extreme weather events than ever before.
Yeah.
Only heat waves and heavy precipitation events seem to be increasing in frequency.
Yeah.
Droughts, floods, hurricanes, all seem to have no seeming trend, or at least not one that the IPCC can identify.
You, like lots of things about the science that we're told to follow, you can make it look as if it's good or bad, depending on how far back you want to go. You know, like I keep saying this week, because there was a story in the Times last week, I can't remember whose study it was, greenhouse gases are currently at the exact same level as they were 3 to 4 billion years ago. Now, you can make any number of different conclusions from that, but my conclusion from it, which I'm going with, is that in that case, our presence on Earth hasn't actually changed anything.
Well, there have been huge changes in the Earth's climate over millennia. Yes, but not in the number of greenhouse gases, though. But yes, there is man-made global warming. We are seeing a change that is quicker than we've seen in previous years. But I think what's the important thing to remember here is that those changes in the climate, while real, have gone alongside an extraordinary improvement in living standards. Mm. The Industrial Revolution expanded the global population to the sort of 7 billion people that we see on the planet today. Most of us wouldn't actually be here if it wasn't for fossil fuels. Yeah. And that development means that we can protect ourselves from the dangers of the climate.
Right.
So we have to look at this climate change issue in the context of vastly improved living standards. And all of the IPCC scenarios, even the most dangerous ones, actually are forecasting a world in which people will be better off in the future.
Right.
So they might be less well off or better off, but they're still predicting that human welfare is going to improve. So when they talk about intergenerational fairness, what they're talking about is sacrificing the poor of today for relatively wealthier people tomorrow. Yes.
So when they talk about the plight of refugees, for example, climate refugees, as they call them, people moving from one country to another because of the climate, I don't think that's true, first of all. Certainly people are moving around the world, but it's not because of necessarily the climate. It might be because of a war, it might be because of a famine, it might be because of some other reason. It might just be that they want to be economic migrants to come live in Britain because it's a nicer part of the world than wherever it is they come from. Similarly, when they talk about people being wiped out by flooding and wiped out by fire, you know, there's no real evidence that that's actually happening, is there?
Well, this is a really dangerous misconception about climate refugees in particular, because it completely lets off the hook corrupt regimes, corrupt governments, and mismanagement, which is always at the heart of political crisis, of war, all of these disastrous events that cause large-scale migration are largely to do with political actions.
Sure.
We shouldn't let them off the hook.
South Sudan,
climate.
A relatively new country created by a war in Sudan, is in a terrible state, not because of climate, but because of the war, in the same way that Ethiopia has had a famine pretty much every year for about the last 50 years. And that isn't going to change anytime soon, and it's nothing to do with the climate and everything to do with the warlords that run Ethiopia.
Yeah, and we can look at the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. These are incredibly wealthy places which don't have those kind of migration problems.
Right.
But they do have an extremely dry and hot climate.
Yeah.
So these climatic factors, while relevant, they shouldn't let poor leadership and poor governance off the hook. We can change all of these things for the better with improvements in economic development, in political governance, and improve transparency and accountability. We shouldn't be distracted from those important aims, which will help the climate too. As countries become wealthier, they also become more environmentally responsible because they can afford to do so.
Of course, but of course, it's only really relatively recently, and I would say in this government, that we are starting to feel the effects of these kind of climate extremists and what they want from the rest of the world. You know, where you get Rishi Sunak making a statement that companies must go green. The FTSE 100 companies must go green, otherwise they'll get taxed more. You know, we must think about having greener housing and greener heating, otherwise we might have to pay more for a mortgage. You know, the fact that people like Land Rover are saying we're not going to promote and sell diesel cars after 2030, we're just not going to make them anymore. You know, there's actually some real things going on as a result of all of this climate extremism, as I call it, and this lobbying that they've all been doing.
Yes, we're already paying a really high cost, and people might not realise just how much they're already paying.
Right.
For example, in terms of natural gas, we pay six times what they pay in the United States because we haven't allowed things like fracking.
We
spend £10 billion a year on renewable energy subsidies.
Yeah.
And many of those subsidies go on business energy bills as well. So they feed through to higher prices
in
the shops.
Well, I mean, they pay a lot less for their petrol and diesel in America as well.
That's right. And this is all a smidgen compared to what's coming down the road. If everyone has to get an electric car in the future, if everyone has to replace their gas boiler. These costs could amplify many, many times over. So we've just started to face the cost of these policies. But make no mistake, these are going to get much, much worse.
And that's what worries a lot of people. And I think it's what worries a lot of Conservative voters who didn't vote this government in to be the Green Party, let's face it. But they are incredibly green. You know, the idea, for example, that, as you say, we're all going to have to be finding ourselves driving electric cars at some point in the next 10 years. Where are they going to get all the charging points from? We saw in Scotland the laughable sight of a bus yesterday being towed by a diesel truck because it had run out of electricity. We saw the laugh in Glen Eagles where all the electric cars had to be charged by a diesel generator because they didn't have enough electric charge points. You know, we're not really geared up yet for this new green economy, are we?
No, so many Conservative voters who I speak to, but also members of the public from a wide cross-section of society are worried about what the costs mean to them. They didn't envisage a government that would be so focused on this green issue and not at the cost of living issues that matter to them. We're facing an inflation crisis. We're facing steeply rising energy bills. Mm. And I think most people would rather the government focused on dealing with those problems.
Yeah, and much of that is down to the fact that we are using the wrong kind of energy, i.e. renewable energy, because there's not enough wind, apparently, and there's not enough solar. And despite the fact that they're insisting that we rely upon that kind of energy, we're not generating enough from it.
Well, there have been a lot of claims about the cost of renewables coming down.
Mm.
But when you actually look at the financial accounts of the companies themselves, we see persistent high costs in these technologies.
Yeah.
And even if the costs
and
were
we're subsidising
them
already as
That's
well.
Right. And even if the costs were coming down, there's still all of these backup costs because fundamentally it's not a reliable technology. The wind doesn't blow sometimes and we have to back it up with diesel generators, with coal power stations, with gas power stations, and all of that backing up costs a lot of money. Yeah. All of the extra grid infrastructure costs a lot of money. So what's being seen as the headline cost for renewables is only a very small part of the story. We need energy which we can rely on the whole time.
Exactly.
And renewables just aren't capable of providing that.
And also, with the last sort of 10 days in mind, Boris Johnson was hopeful that this was going to be his kind of defining moment. He was going to go there, emerge from the dust and the ruins of this last climate COP26 conference as the conquering hero of the new world, and he was going to lead the way and make everybody understand how important this is as an issue. But instead, he's kind of crawling away from it as if it's a car crash, because they've now organised another one, COP27, in Egypt next year, meaning that they haven't at 1 minute to midnight solved anything. They're unlikely to get anything worth actually producing as a statement. I'm told they're probably likely not to make the deadline of 6 p.m. tonight. They're probably going to be working all night to come up with a statement which is going to mean nothing, really. So what was the point of it all?
Well, one criticism that you can lay at Boris's door is that he doesn't really have any particular strong principles that he's committed to, but put his own ambitions first.
and
that's exactly what we've seen with this. I think what Boris imagined would be here would be this big event with him striding the world stage.
Like a colossus.
Achieving this huge agreement.
Yeah.
Rather than actually being particularly concerned about the details of climate policy.
No.
Yes, of course, he's adopted all this quite hysterical language about climate change, but we see this at every COP conference. At the start, they say this is the last chance to save the world. And then in the middle, the negotiations stumble.
Yeah.
They put together a document of what they think everyone can accept.
China
but often
chucks
it's,
their toys out the pram.
Often it's watered down quite a degree. But then they nonetheless claim to have saved the world the next moment.
Right.
And then this whole thing repeats itself again and again. We have to suddenly save the world again. The world is suddenly saved again. And then we meet another year and the whole
charade
goes on.
But the trouble is, at what point will the politicians and these kind of climate experts, so-called, realise that the rest of the country, and certainly an awful lot of the people in the rest of the world, are just laughing at them? Because we don't actually care that much. I know everybody says they care about the climate, but actually, once you start to tell them they're going to have to pay more money through taxes, or they're going to have to charge more money through their car purchasing or their house purchasing, it's all going to have to get a lot more expensive. They're not so keen.
Well, it was striking earlier in the COP conference. The BBC had almost every story on their front page was COP26 related. Right. And yet you looked at the most popular corner and you saw that the top 10 articles, none of them had anything to do with
Very interesting.
People are being turned off by it. And the Daily Mail poll suggested that on the one hand, the public wanted the government to go further on climate change when they were explicitly asked about it.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, a huge number of people weren't willing to spend any more in terms of dealing with it. And then the next biggest group were saying maybe they would spend just a very small amount. Mm. So clearly there's a disconnect between people's willingness to pay. And
also, they want to look as if they're nice people when you ask them a question. It's the same as those who used to say, we want more lockdown restrictions. They didn't really, but they just thought they'd better say that because that was the right answer. And the virtue signalling way of the world that right now is that you must care about the climate. You can't go around saying you don't care about it because that would make you a monster, wouldn't it?
That's what we all want, to see a better environment.
Yeah.
No one disagrees with that. And I think people want to be seen to be on the right side of that argument. But where politicians are diverging from the public is they're viewing the environment in this very narrow way. What they're looking at is in terms of only through the prism of decarbonisation and CO2 and renewable energy technology. The public realise that the environment is a much wider issue. They're looking at not polluting the oceans.
Well, it would be nice if you could swim off the coast of Britain without running into something rather unmentionable. But there we are. Listen,
That's
good
right.
to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Harry Wilkinson, head of policy at Net Zero Watch. COP26? No, that was a Freudian slip. COP26 was an absolute and utter waste of time, money, and indeed energy. So thank God it's going to be over at 6 o'clock tonight.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, the world headquarters of common sense, the home of the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. We're going to be getting into some very interesting stuff in this hour of the show. We're going to be talking to Paul Thacker, who's an investigative journalist, because the British Medical Journal has written a piece about why Pfizer's vaccine trials should probably be put under a little bit of scrutiny, because apparently revelations of poor practices at a contract research company helping to carry out Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine trial raise questions about data integrity and regularity oversight. Now, it turns out that in Texas, researchers skewed data, didn't follow up with patients who had side effects, and failed to test people with symptoms. Now, that strikes me as somewhat negligent. Doesn't it strike you as somewhat negligent? I've been saying for a long time on this show, listen, if you don't want to get vaccinated, you don't have to. You shouldn't have to do it in order to keep your job in a care home. You certainly shouldn't have to do it in order to keep your job at the NHS. If you do want to get vaccinated, go ahead. But what I'd like to see from the government is more information, more clarity, more transparency about what it is that is affecting people who are badly affected by the vaccine, who get side effects, who do become quite ill as a result. People like Mike Yardley, who we talk to on a regular basis here at Talk Radio, who had a first vaccine, which was an AstraZeneca, I think, and was so badly affected by it, he didn't have the second one. We need more knowledge, we need more information, we need more honesty from our governments. And I think that's what we're going to be asking Paul Thacker to explain to us. 0344 499 1000. We're going to do shortage of the day. We're going to be talking about the NHS as well, and why waiting lists have now gone up to something like 6 million people. Unbelievable. 0344 499 1000 is the number. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
So according to an article in the British Medical Journal, right, a whistleblower who worked at Pfizer, worked at the firm that was paid to run a trial, documented dozens of failings. She provided the British Medical Journal with a number of documents, proof of photographic form. Failings included the way that vaccines were stored. They were stored wrongly. Underqualified staff who were hired to do the actual tests and do the actual trial. And as I said, people who had side effects were not followed up. They didn't really care about what was not right about these particular trials. And of course, Pfizer is now the booster of choice that people are being asked to go and get by Sajid Javid and Boris Johnson and every other member of the government. So let's talk now to Paul Thacker, investigative journalist who writes for a great many outlets, including the Daily Beast. Paul, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much indeed. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm always slightly suspicious of any organisation that is not entirely sort of transparent about the things that could go wrong. One of the problems that we have in this country with our government, as far as I'm concerned, is that, you know, they do admit to having this yellow card system where you can report incidences of, you know, bad side effects or even death from the vaccine, but they're not very good at talking about it. Tell us a bit more about this story in Texas.
So what happened was, about a month ago, the British Medical Journal was approached by a woman who worked at a contracting company that was doing seeing patients as part of the what's called the phase three clinical trial for Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. So what happens, pharmaceutical companies don't tend to do their own research. They parcel out contracts to private groups, academic research centers, to get the total patients they need for a clinical trial. And this is a group in Texas, a private group. And she had worked there for a couple of weeks. And after she kept complaining about problems at the company, they eventually pushed her out the door. The day that they had fired her, she alerted the FDA. She's filed a formal complaint with the FDA about problems she was seeing at her company. And she was fired later that day. What we found interesting was that the FDA then never bothered to follow up and inspect Ventavia,
right,
after they had been given a, you know, credible allegations of problems there.
And so as far as that is concerned, I mean, presumably there are a lot of these companies around the country which have been carrying out various different trials. I mean, who's supposed to be policing all that? Presumably Pfizer.
Well, there's a couple ways that it works. Usually these companies work for what are called contract research organizations, which are like kind of oversee the various groups below. And then Pfizer is also involved in looking at it. But also who is involved is the federal government through the Food and Drug Administration, right? And of course, they are the ultimate, you know, authority on these issues. They are the ones who are supposed to oversee, you know, private research groups. They then go through and approve these products. And what's happening is that they're just not doing any inspection. So when we went back and looked, one of the biggest reports we could find was from the Health and Human Services. FDA sits with inside Health and Human Services. And there's an office of the Inspector General. They looked at how often FDA inspects these clinical research sites. And what they found was they only inspect around 1% of them.
Right. So they expect the rest to just sort of go along and hope for the best. But I mean, what's interesting here as well for me is effectively, Paul, that we've got a vaccine which has been rolled out very quickly. We keep being told on this side of the Atlantic anyway, that, you know, yes, it was rushed through, but all of the necessary tests were done. Everything was done according to plan. But at the same time, we always hear from some doctors and medical people, well, the thing is, the reason that we've changed our view about whether kids should get it or whether pregnant women should have it is that we're learning things about the vaccine all the time. So they can't really have it both ways, can they? Surely the trials will show certain information, but the more the trials are studied, they're finding out more and more.
Well, I mean, that has to do with, you know, studies that happen after a product is approved. Yeah. You know, in order to get a product approved, you can only test so many people.
Right.
In this case, 44,000 people were tested for this particular clinical trial. Now, when Brooke Jackson reported these problems to the FDA, she reported to them that Ventavia had enrolled 1,000 patients in the total trial. We went back and I just spoke to another former Ventavia employee who was there after Brooke Jackson was fired. She said that Brooke Jackson did not understand the totality of patients that Ventavia enrolled. She said it was closer to 10% of the total people that were in that clinical trial.
Right.
Pfizer and Ventavia will not respond to questions, by the way, explaining exactly how many people Ventavia saw for that total clinical trial.
Right. And is Pfizer one of the vaccines that's being rolled out to the under 12s in the US? Because I know they've started that process in some states, haven't they?
Correct. I believe there's just an emergency authorization for that. That happened. There's been a couple different meetings on it in the United States. Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, what is the attitude in the US towards vaccinating children? Because I mean, here in this country, the rollout didn't work very well. A lot of kids didn't want it. A lot of parents didn't want their kids to have it. And that was just down to 12 as opposed to below 12. I can't imagine that in this country, many people would want their under 12 year olds to be vaccinated.
You know, I haven't looked at like the latest statistics on that. It is rather controversial. There's a lot of concerns about, you know, whether kids need it or not. There's some push by the government to have mandates.
Yeah.
It's become incredibly, in the United States, it's incredibly controversial right now for a variety of reasons. There is a split in which the most part, I would say the medical community is pretty much in favor of, you know, kids getting it. Although there are a minority of medical doctors who still have concerns and don't think it's legitimate, but there is a pretty strong sentiment among, I would say, maybe 30-40% of Americans about kids getting these vaccines.
But America is quite a sort of, shall we say, medically sort of preventative country, isn't it? Because preventative care is a much bigger thing in the US than it is here. Whereas here, for example, I think many parents say, well, it's all very well telling people up to the age of, you know, over the age of 18, you can make your own decision. Even sort of say 17 to 18 year olds, you can make your own decision, even though we don't know quite what the long-term effects might be. But you can't really expect a 12-year-old or somebody even under 12 to be able to focus on all of the information and to understand all of the information and to actually go, yeah, that's fine, I'm quite happy to have it. They're just going to go along with what their parents say, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, of course. But I mean, even I think for a lot of parents, I think it's really confusing and hard to understand. And I think partly that's just because, you know, I mean, look, this is a very confusing issue. It's not totally clear. Like, we've been getting mixed messages in the United States. Yeah. And partly that's, you know, it's probably poor messaging, but also, you know, I mean, evidence changes. This virus is changing.
Right.
Evidence around the efficacy of these vaccines is also altering.
Yeah, that's right. And also the way that the information is dealt with and handled by the government. For example, I'm reading in the BMJ piece that the trial of children taking the vaccine under 12 was just 2,000 strong, which is not a very big number. And I think as a parent, I would like to see what the long-term effects are, if you could know what they are. You know, if you're getting an MMR vaccine, for example, for your kids, or you're getting a polio vaccine or something like that, you know, kind of, because it's been around for a long time, that it's fine.
Right.
But what we don't know yet about Pfizer, about AstraZeneca, and about the way that these things are being rolled out is we don't yet know whether there could be an issue with future fertility or with anything else to do with, you know, medical problems that children might have had in the past, which could be exacerbated by the vaccine.
Well, I would not worry about fertility. I don't think there's any evidence of that. But what you are getting at, though, is an important issue, which is when you say that there's only 2,000 in that clinical trial. I mean, I haven't looked at that. But if you compare that to the adult trial, 44,000, this is like pretty common in all pediatric clinical trials. In pediatric clinical trials, the numbers are always much, much tinier than they are in adults.
Yeah.
In many situations, it's sort of a me too process in which we've tested it now in adults. Let's make some slight variations and test it, like, you know, in a few thousand kids to confirm, you know, for children. That's pretty common in pediatric clinical trials, unfortunately.
Yeah. And as far as this whistleblower is concerned, is she talking to an awful lot of people? Is she being interviewed by anybody from the official sort of, you know, medical agencies or anything?
Well, what's happened with her is Ventavia now has been putting out libelous and false statements about her.
Oh, dear.
They're now trying to say that she actually did not work on the clinical trial, on these clinical trials. Apparently, her lawyer has just sent a cease and desist letter to Ventavia. And these false libelous allegations have appeared in various media accounts, including a story that appeared, I believe, just yesterday in the Daily Mail, in which they're saying that she actually was not, you know, working on that clinical trial. I want to get back to, I think, which is the most important issue about here, which is the lack of FDA oversight on these issues. I want to read to you one email that we have from, this is an internal Ventavi email. And I also want to emphasize something. We did not write this story based upon allegations that Brooke Jackson brought to us. This was based off of what she told us, but everything was confirmed by internal documents within Ventavia. So these are issues that Ventavia was saying internally, not what Brooke Jackson was saying. And I just want to give you, I'm going to read you one email that went out right before she filed her complaint with the FDA. And this is an internal Ventavia document. And it says, I know I've said this several times, but I'll say it again here. It's not a matter of if, in all caps, the FDA is coming. It's a matter of when, all caps, the FDA is coming. Mm. And they are coming soon. This is the biggest clinical trial in the entire world, and we are a top enroller. And this is in all caps, in bold. The FDA is coming soon, like in a matter of days, if I had to make a guess.
Right.
So this internal email goes on inside of Ventavia. Brooke Jackson then files a complaint with the FDA, and the FDA did nothing.
And that is the problem, isn't it? If the FDA is not responding to this, is there a reason for that?
Look, what I like to say is you get the government you pay for. We are in a situation in the United States in which we don't want to increase taxes to pay for government services. And so then you have an FDA that is not sufficiently funded in order to do things that we think it should be doing.
Right.
So we're going to continue to have an underfunded FDA until we decide to fund them better. That's the reality.
And that is going to be the problem. And as far as the kind of the long term is concerned, from the population's point of view, are COVID rates pretty much stable in America now?
As someone who I don't follow this like incredibly aggressively,
right,
but I can just tell you things just keep changing all the time and it's really hard to keep up.
Yeah.
The best I can say is that what seems to be clear is that we're going to see an increase again, as we approach winter. My general thoughts on this has been, we have Thanksgiving, which is the last Friday of this month of November, where we all come together across the country. So people are going to be coming all together across the country. My guess is that about 2 weeks after that, we're going to see another
surge.
Before Christmas.
Yeah, just in time. Great stuff. Well, listen, really good to talk to you, Paul. Thanks very much indeed for taking the time. Paul Thacker, investigative journalist there, on the rather disturbing story of Pfizer and one of its kind of satellite companies, which it doesn't own, but which it used to run some of the trials on the vaccine. And it didn't look as though they did the right thing. And they're now currently engulfed in a sort of a libelous situation with one of their whistleblowers who's told us that they weren't doing the job right. It's not in and of itself a crisis. It doesn't mean anything necessarily about the actual state of the vaccine and how safe it is. But what it does tell you is that, again, we're not being told everything that's going on. The truth is out there, and it's up to us to find it. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio with you, of course, until 1 o'clock. Ian Collins will be here to tell us what's going on just before that. Don't forget, you can watch it all as it happens live right here on television. Apple TV, Rakuten, Samsung TV Plus, Roku, YouTube. Now we're on Amazon Fire TV as well. You can watch us on a great variety of devices, including televisions. You can watch us on flat screens. You can watch us on watches. You can watch us on iPads, tablets, all manner of different things. You watch us on your phone if you like, just while you're on the go. And it's a great thing. It's a wonderful thing. And you will not be surprised to hear that we are growing ever more every single day of the week. More and more people watching us as well as listening to us as well. Now, we've been talking about a great many things this morning. And what we haven't got around to doing yet is the latest story from the NHS, which is basically the shortages, the pressure, and of course, the system is collapsing, creaking around its very ears. And we're going to talk now to Lizzie Barclay, Medical Director of Aidence, a former NHS radiologist, of course, because at the moment we're now being told that the waiting lists of people who want some kind of NHS operation or some kind of procedure is nearing 6 million. Aidence is a company of medical experts and software developers responsible for the new artificial intelligence tech to help ease the workload on radiologists. But the question is, have we got an NHS which is essentially analogue, trying to operate in a digital world? I think that's part of the problem. Lizzie, a very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I mean, I talk about the NHS obviously quite a lot. You have great experience of working inside it. It does strike me that parts of it just don't fit with other parts. You know, that there are, I mean, we were told, for example, that an awful lot of the data collection was very old fashioned and it was brought back to kind of, you know, the 21st century by one of Boris Johnson's advisors who was in Downing Street, brought in by Dominic Cummings. And, you know, so we started to kind of not waste everybody's time collecting data. But it seems to me that there's a lot more going wrong, if you like, than just the kind of administration of it.
I'm probably not an expert in all the different tech systems that are in use in the NHS, but yeah, you're right. There's definitely a need, and I think there's a big drive and push at the moment from a lot of clinicians to actually improve the technology that's, you know, actually being used in practice.
Right.
And yeah, one of our roles working, we're now working in artificial intelligence, as you said, and trying to make sure that the very kind of advanced technology that we're providing does actually integrate well with what's actually being used in practice. Okay. So it is a challenge.
So tell us a bit about what it is that your technology does.
Yeah, sure. So essentially it's... we've trained the software, the technology, to actually be able to recognize, it's like pattern recognition of CT images. Mm. And the idea is that the more images that it's seen, a bit like the way a human brain works, the more images that you see, you become better at recognizing what we're looking for, which are lung nodules. So right. These are small abnormalities in the lungs. That's what we've trained it to do.
Okay. So is it a matter then of getting the people in front of that technology so that you could look at them? Is that the hard part?
So I guess there are a few bits that are difficult. Getting hold of data in the first place, as you talked about, actually being, you know, you need data to be able to train these algorithms, to train these artificial intelligence models. But once you, and I will point out that the only data we actually need is the images itself. You know, there isn't a need to have access to all of the medical records of the patients. It's purely having those images, which can be anonymized.
Right.
And then once we have, which we now do have, a device that that works, and we've done studies to prove that it does work. And then it's about, yeah, getting it into the NHS, getting it actually used in practice, yeah. Because that's where it's going to have its effect.
And would it be best used at sort of GP level to try and detect whether there's a problem which can then be referred on to a specialist?
No. So it works. It needs to be used by radiologists. Right. So they're the doctors who specialise in medical image analysis and right. Reading your medical images. So it needs to be used by those. So it's actually hospitals or I think, you know, there'll be more diagnostic centres, more in the community. It's right. Probably what we're heading towards.
Right.
So it's radiologists that use our technology.
And there's talk, isn't there, from the government of setting up more of those kind of centres of clinical excellence, whatever you want to call them, so that people can go and get access quicker to those kinds of services. So presumably this will be part of the rollout of extra money, which is coming from Rishi Sunak once we all start paying more tax in April.
Yeah, I hope so.
Sorry to be involving you in all this political knockabout stuff, but I mean, you can't really separate the two things, can you?
Yeah, no. I think, I can't comment on what's to come. And I know there's lots of great ideas how we can improve, getting people seen in the community who don't necessarily need to be seen in hospital.
Right.
Making sure we get people seen in the right places. And so, for example, the targeted lung health check, which is what we're involved in, this is an NHS England screening program, essentially, the aim is to actually increase the percentage of patients who are diagnosed early with lung cancer. So, because if you're diagnosed early, lung cancer can be treated and cured.
Right.
But unfortunately, often these patients or individuals don't actually present because they don't get the symptoms until the disease itself is really quite advanced.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is, you know, and NHS have brought in this program. So like you said, it will be a bit more community based. Some of the scanners are actually on mobile trucks. I don't know if you've seen in the news, there'll be mobile trucks in supermarket car parks,
right.
and places that make it a lot easier for somebody to say, hey, I'm eligible to have a scan. I don't have to go to the hospital. I can get my scan actually on this truck that's in a supermarket.
And there's a shortage, I understand. I don't know whether this is relevant to our conversation, of radiologists. I'm not quite sure why that is, but we do a feature here called Shortage of the Day about things that we're running out of. And apparently we have got a shortage of radiologists. Why is that?
We do. There's a huge shortage. I think it's around about 33% we don't have that we need in the NHS to meet the demand.
And what is that,
because
people have left or there's just not a recruitment? What?
Well, I am. Yeah, it's a mixture of both. Obviously, I'm an example of somebody that has left. I left a few years ago because I felt like I could have a wider impact on the NHS in this role that I now do.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's also about funding, investment in actually training more doctors. You know, there's not a shortage of doctors wanting to go into radiology, but there needs to be the investment in actually training up those doctors to become radiologists.
Right. Because obviously, if you've got the technology to find yourself being able to knock back on the waiting lists, and you're able to see more people, diagnose more people, you're going to need more people, presumably, to operate the machinery, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hope, and we'll be hopefully proving this with a coming research project we're doing with the NHSX. Mm. But as well as helping to detect early lung cancers, hopefully we'll also be able to speed up the actual time it takes a radiologist to report a scan, because right. the technology has already kind of read the scan, if that makes sense. So yeah. it will hopefully actually improve efficiency as well.
Right. And then again, the knock-on effect, hopefully to knock down the waiting list time, or the waiting time for people to get seen, will improve as well.
Hopefully, but I mean, that's like you've said, I mean, we're only one piece of the puzzle, this technology. Mm. You know, you've got to align all the right things. You've got to have the right setup for, you know, the knock-on effect. If you're diagnosing people, you need to make sure you've got then the cancer doctors, specialists who are able to see those patients. Mm. So it is a big challenge. I think that's why the targeted lung health check program's actually being rolled out in phases.
Yeah.
So it started, there's only about 20 or so sites that are doing it at the moment in England. Mm. And hopefully over time it will become a national program.
So how would somebody know to come for a scan if they didn't have any symptoms? How does that work?
They get invited based on risk factors. So that, sorry, the main risk factors.
So if you're a smoker or something.
Yeah, exactly. The main ones are smoking and age. So over 55 years old, and you're either a current or previous heavy smoker. That doesn't mean to say there aren't other people that, you know, that haven't smoked that can also get lung cancer. Mm. But at the moment, this targeted lung health check, it is about smoking history.
Okay. And as far as the cancers that it can detect at the moment, it's just lung cancer, or can it detect other forms of cancer?
Yeah, so our company is at the moment specialised in lung cancer and purely looking at CT scans. Right. You know, maybe over time we'll also look at different things. But yeah, for now it's trying to really focus in on the lung cancer and help with that. Right.
Okay, fascinating stuff. Well, thank you very much indeed. And that's Lizzie Barkley, Medical Director at Aidence. She's formerly an NHS radiologist, works with technology company now, which is getting under the skin, hopefully, of cancer, trying to detect it quicker, trying to detect it more speedily as well, and trying to cut down on some of these waiting times, which have now ballooned up to nearly 6 million. And if you're one of those people waiting for an operation, I'd love to hear your story, because, of course, we're all about sharing stories here at Talk Radio. And what your personal experience of the NHS is would be very valuable, because, of course, if you can't get to see a GP and you can't get to be recommended or referred to another part of the NHS, then the journey has already stopped before it started, hasn't it?
Talk Radio, across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.